Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast.
Still really awkward starting this without a quote. So welcome to episode 427. I think this is Props and Slops 8 or 9, something like that. I'm Will, and the usuals are with me.
Hi, I'm Aaron. Roy. Yeah, I know, but you're supposed to know that we do this in order of joining the show. You're not new.
No, you know what, Aaron? No. I have been on this show now for a while, and I did not know that we do it in the order in which of joining the show. So
We have not been doing that. Aaron's been like introducing himself, and then Roy and I try to wait each other out in this Midwest standoff, and then we talk over each other.
That's fair. It's one of the few times that I guess we've talked over each other, Aaron.
I vote that we go in order of joining the show from now on.
Sure.
Problem okay. Solved.
I guess that's I like what we'll it. Do then.
All right.
Before we got started on this week's episode, I wanted to ask folks who may not have listened to last week's White Book to listen to the whole episode, which is quite enjoyable. We talk about the core set. But really what I want you to do is listen to the message that Will and I shared at the end, which is, of course, emphasizing that Black Lives Matter and that people should take action in their own lives and their own communities to make sure that Black lives are respected. And I just want to follow up this week and say that that's still true this week and that people should keep at it. And it's an ongoing process and not just simply one weekend of protests or even 2 weekends of protests. It's an ongoing process that's going to go on for probably all of our lives and our children's lives and our grandchildren's lives, because white supremacy and inequality are features of American history. And it's something that needs to be dealt with throughout.
Here we go.
All right. So
on to lighter stuff.
On to lighter stuff. So we are going to be breaking down our props and slops into categories this week. We'll do TVs and movies, comics and books, then games and video games. We're going to begin with TVs and movies. Will, would you like to prop or slop HBO Max?
Oh, man, I'm torn. If I had to give it one or the other straight up, I'm probably going to give it a slop. There's a variety of factors for this. Gosh, where to start? Let's go with AT&T, Warner Brothers, slapdash, completely unplanned, seat of their pants operating style in regards to streaming. I believe this is the fourth or fifth streaming service that they own and operate now. It's because they've got, I think it's two different AT&T streaming services. They've got DC Unlimited, HBO Max, and then I believe they also own Crunchyroll. So, and I may be missing something. So it's kind of just insane to be that all over the place, and there's some overlap and some isn't. Like, I started watching Doom Patrol on HBO Max, which I will sub prop Doom Patrol at least, which is really, really fun. But they're so scattershot. The price point, like, is so high. It's nearly three times Disney Plus, right? It's $15 a month for HBO Max, and Disney Plus is what, $6.99, something like that? $5.99? No, it's $5.99, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, I don't necessarily expect them to like undercut as hard as Disney, but it's really hard to justify three times as much on top of everything else. On top of that, they've got some real like brand awkwardness going on here. HBO is heavily associated in like all of society's minds with what, Sopranos, Game of Thrones, like not family friendly fare, as good as the shows may be. And yet they're also full of, sorry, HBO Max, that is also full of Sesame Street and Looney Tunes, and has a section devoted to like family friendly movies and stuff. Like it just feels like they are constantly just shooting themselves in the foot. If this was branded as middle of the road with like different tabs, I hate to just tell them to mimic Disney Plus, but the very clear tabs for like Disney stuff, Nat Geo, Star Wars, Marvel, whatever, like it's a very straightforward categorization system that points people to the type of stuff they want while still having it in this broad like brand umbrella. And HBO Max it is all mixed up and muddled together. And it just, I want to like it, but I just can't. Oh, and the free trial period is only 1 week. 1 week compared to every other streaming system having a month or longer in time of pandemic. And it's just mind-boggling. Sorry, I will keep going, slopping it if I don't stop myself.
So I have one really big slop for it. It's not available on Fire TVs, which means I can't even watch it.
Yes, also true. I think it's not available on Apple TV too.
Or Roku.
Yeah.
So geez. it's cutting out. I think they said like 80 million users. That's completely ridiculous. Like I was really excited. My wife really enjoyed Studio Ghibli movies, but we're very lazy and hate using the DVD player as it requires us to like rejigger the wires and like it's annoying. So we were looking forward to that. I was looking forward to watching some old Humphrey Bogart stuff, and I really, really, really wanted to show my son some Looney Tunes. And so, like, HBO Max comes out, I figure out how I'm going to get it, everything happens, and then I can't get it, and now I hate it forever. So, like,
it's probably
forever. Like, don't get me, like, just make the deals necessary. Disney had the same problem for, like, 2 seconds. They were like, screw it, we're making the deal. This is important, right? Like, that's how Disney was so successful. They made every deal with everyone, and HBO, or Warner's, I guess, lack of willingness to do so, and their completely crap DC selection, right, are just unforgivable.
Yeah, it's all over the place. But I will give one other small sub prop to the fact that the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is on there, which we've started rewatching, which is just lots of good fun.
That's pretty cool.
There's a ton of stuff I would love to watch on it that I'm not going to. So
yeah,
thanks HBO.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'll say thanks AT&T. I'm not sure they really know what to do with their Warner purchase.
It shouldn't have been different. Like the model is there. This should have been really easy to do.
Yeah. It's like, it's so crazy that, they, of course, own DC Comics, right? Which means they own Bizarro, one of the more tragic characters. And it's like everything that DC/Warner/AT&T does is like the Bizarro version of what like Marvel, Disney do. They're just like, oh, I see this. I want to do it. I'm just going to do it in this really like scrambled manner. And it's so sad.
But you get the Snyder Cut, Will.
That's actually what I was about to slop. I'm just going to slop the entire concept of the Snyder Cut.
Yeah.
Like this is going to be his first good movie. Relax.
Hey, he's had other good moves. I honestly thought his Watchmen was about the best adaptation of the graphic novel I could have expected.
So it was
Sucker Punch is fun.
Wait. So Watchmen wasn't an adaptation. It was as close as he can get to a shot-by-shot remake of the comic.
And I was okay with that.
Right, but that's not a remake, right? Like, he didn't do anything. He kept the same framing as the comic.
Sure.
Like, he didn't do, like, he added nothing to it. Except, like, maybe if I don't break this, it'll be okay. Right?
Like, sometimes that's good. Have you watched, like, I don't know, Aragon or any dozen other terrible versions?
I have not. But look, so he made an okay movie that was a straight adaptation, and Sucker Punch is fun, but marvelously dumb.
Yeah. No, I can agree with that.
So it's not like Justice League is going to be like this cinema. He's not. He's shown no indication that he's capable of making a cinematic masterpiece.
That's fair.
Yeah. And it's just crazy. They're spending, what is it, another $30 million to go back and finish it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very happy about that. The more money they spend, the more likely to just sell to Disney.
They're not going to do that.
I mean, I don't need Disney owning anything else.
I'm fine with Disney just owning pop culture at this point. Eventually, like, it's, our society will be just and they'll get destroyed. But, like, like they just... until then, like, at least they manage their properties well. There's no Disney property.
I mean, I've got a Star Wars sequel trilogy that might beg to differ.
Sure, but, like, that was their first, like, big try with it, right? And, like, then they're like, oh, Mandalorian, oh, another season of Clone Wars, right? Like, even if you don't like part of it, they're, like...
Well, not everything they did was a misstep.
Right.
I mean, but, like, Rogue One was good.
Almost everything that...
Force Awakens and Last Jedi were fine, too. Like, I mean, it's really only they punted at the end.
We don't need to rehash the Last Jedi business.
Yeah, let's not do that right now, because we're about to... Actually, might as well just use this as our transition to... I'm slopping the living shit out of her right at this end.
Sure.
I watched Clone Wars, as you all know. I really, really enjoyed the Clone Wars show. I used Ritter's viewing order. It was a truly excellent experience. And then I watched Revenge of the Sith. Like, it actually excited about it, because I've always hated it, right? But I've only seen it, like, twice. I saw it when it came out, and then I saw it early on the DVD. I was like, I'm really going to like this. I've got all this backstory. I'm going to get really into it. It was atrocious. It wasn't a movie. It's, like, almost exactly the same problems as The Rise of the Skywalker. Like, it's not a movie. It's a bunch of shit that happens, like, without rhyme or reason, without setup. Things happen without, like... Everything that does happen isn't set up, and everything that's set up doesn't happen. It's really, really bad. And Hayden Christensen is he's a bad actor in the second movie, but oh my god, his delivery of dialogue. Like, I've been sending my least favorite line to people because it is just so mind-bogglingly terrible the way he delivers it. It's a terrible line, but his delivery is absolutely ridiculously bad. Like, I hate that movie with a fiery passion. It is terrible.
I famously like Revenge of the Sith. I think it's the best prequel.
You were just posting about that pretty recently, weren't you?
Yes, I was, because Al and I rewatched it. We periodically actually watch the prequels because we both really enjoy them for what they are, which is campy, ambitious mess. And I think Revenge of the Sith is the most successful at what it does. And I think that it's playing with some really interesting ideas and really interesting themes. And it has some of the best performances of any of the prequels. Like, Ian McDiarmid, I think, is really good. I think Ewan McGregor, it's his best turn as Obi-Wan. I think Frank Oz does a good job as Yoda. I think I've actually come around to Sam Jackson as Mace Windu in the movie.
Oh, he's terrible. He's so bad.
See,
holy shit, is he so bad.
I mean, I'd never watch and probably will never watch what's that thing called that you were talking about? Oh, Clone Wars.
Clone Wars?
Clone Wars. So
he's barely in Clone Wars. He's completely irrelevant. So
I don't have any like strong prequel feelings. Probably the prequels. I mean, I have stronger prequel feelings than I have feelings about the what's that thing called? The sequel trilogy. But I'm still not really that strong because I haven't really invested in the overall fiction. But yeah, I think overall, yeah, I just think Revenge of the Sith is better than you're giving it credit for. I'm not saying like, but how am I put this? Sitting here at 35, I have very different standards for like what a good movie is, or not maybe what a good movie is, movies that I enjoy. And Revenge of the Sith definitely falls under that, and other people's mileage may vary.
But Roy, from my perspective, the Jedi are evil.
Yeah, that is a great line. That is a great line.
Worst line I've ever heard with the worst delivery in a movie. It's so bad.
Wow.
I've literally, like, outside of sheer cant movies, like, it's the worst line in a real movie I've ever heard. Period.
I don't know. I just have to say I'm in a different spot here. Revenge of the Sith is bad. Out of the prequels, The Phantom Menace, for all of its awkwardness, is probably the best, even if it is bizarrely disconnected and the wrong story to have told. At least it kind of does tell a story.
So,
I mean,
the first two held up significantly better than I thought. I've always hated both of them. And I thought, like, both Phantom and why can't I think of it? Attack of the Clones were perfectly fine. Like, Phantom is a good kids movie. It does weird political things in the middle of its kids movie. Like, with trade embargoes, that doesn't really need to happen in the middle of a kids movie. But, like, besides that, it's a fun kids movie. Even Jar Jar wasn't completely terrible, besides being weird and terrible, but like he wasn't as like, for a kids movie character, he was fine. And almost everything about Clone Wars is good except Hayden Christensen is atrocious. Like, the movie is fine except he is such a bad actor that, like, him being in the middle of everything,
I mean,
him being in the middle of everything ruins a lot of that movie. But, like,
yeah, I mean,
the actual movie itself is perfectly fine.
This is where you and I will always disagree. I think the fundamental point is, I think the basic plot of Revenge of the Sith is a good plot. I don't think it's particularly perfect. Yes,
it doesn't follow any plot structure. It begins in media res, and then shit just starts happening.
It's about the fall of Anakin to the dark side. Like,
he just, like, teleports.
Yeah,
I understand that it's purely
morality does.
It's not about things. You can be about something and not have a plot. There's no structure to that movie.
Fair, fine. Attack, but and you think that Attack of the Clones is well structured?
No. The structure is completely derailed by the giant romance subplot in the middle of it. Right, like, it wrecks the structure, but like the rest of the movie is perfectly fine.
I don't know. We're just going to fundamentally disagree. I think we're generating more heat than knowledge here. You'll never convince me that Attack of the Clones is...
Right. From Roy's point of view.
Oh, yes.
The Jedi are evil.
Yes.
From
a certain point of view.
The way he says the Jedi is just like he's just discovered the word and he's never said it before. It's amazing.
Okay.
That's a good way to think of that.
From my point of view, the Jedi are even so, oh my god. I literally, my head, like, and then, like, 2 seconds later, give up, I have the higher route, and then, like, he doesn't kill it. It's just bad. It's just so bad. It's just so bad. And then 18 prologues, because Peter Jackson did it. Alright. Let's stay in space. I want to very lukewarmly prop Space Force. Have either of you watched that yet?
No.
Just the first episode, but I did like it.
I think it's not what I was looking for. I think that what I was looking for was sort of Galaxy Quest meets The Office, and it's very not that.
Well, that would have been interesting.
What?
Oh, just said that would have been interesting. Any Galaxy Quest reference gets me.
Yeah, I was looking for like a hard satire, but like in space. Or like a, not hard satire, but like actual satire, but in space of like that genre and basically like treating it like a workplace. And it's not that. It's almost a dramedy. It's reasonably funny, but like I'm having real like genre issues with it. I'm not sure there's anything like it, and I'm not sure it's in a good way. It's funny, and I don't hate the characters, but I can't. It doesn't fit with anything I've ever seen in a very strange way.
I mean, it sounds like mid-season The Office?
No, it's not. It's too serious for The Office. Like, it's nothing. Like, the characters are too straight, right? Like, even when they're absurd, they're like. No, not the three episodes a night. So I'm not done with it, right? Like the three episodes I'm in, maybe it takes a while to find its voice. But the three episodes I'm in, it has nothing in common with The Office besides Steve Carell.
Well, and the showrunners and.
Right. But it's not the right. It's not the same tone. It's not a sitcom. It's not sitcom.
Fair.
Which is a weird decision because what it was sold as was Netflix's replacement for The Office, which it's losing to HBO Max.
Oh.
No, not HBO Max. Peacock. What is
that? Oh, to yeah, Peacock. No, to Peacock. You're right. Peacock is free, so I'm not against Peacock.
Is Peacock free?
Peacock is free. They have I think they're supposed to have a free version. They have a couple of tickets.
Oh, right. It's like Hulu, right?
No, it's like Hulu, but it's got
like Hulu used Hulu. To be.
Hulu doesn't have a free option anymore?
No.
No.
Ah, okay.
I'm all for Peacock. Look, Mike Schur has a new show, and Mike Schur has yet to let me down in any way, shape, or form. I need people to talk about Space Force with. So, listeners, if you've seen Space Force, let me know. Because I'm not challenged by it. It's not complicated or even really smart. But I don't know what it's doing. I don't know what its intended audience is. Like, I usually understand the feel of a show and what it's aiming at and what it's doing, whether it's for me or not. And I don't know if I get Space Force. I'm not sure.
Which is fair. I mean, I haven't seen it. I don't know if I'll get around to watching it, but if I do, I'll definitely let you know.
I'm definitely going to keep watching it because my wife is really enjoying it.
Oh, well.
She just thinks it's really fun.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we've just been really kind of watching Avatar. That's kind of been our thing. So.
Ooh, good choice.
I asked Carly yesterday, I was like, do you want to start Space Force or Avatar? And she was like, let's do Space Force. And so here we are.
That's completely fair.
We'll do Avatar after it. Space Force isn't long.
Yeah, it's only, what, 8 episodes or something?
8 to 10, I don't remember. General. Yeah, general.
I'm going to say 10.
Yeah, most Netflix shows are 10, but I heard it was shorter for some reason. I don't know.
Well, I will check as we move on to comic books, where Will is going to prop or slop DC distribution.
Yeah. This will be a two-parter, I guess. I'm going to prop the decision and slop the way it was carried out.
Are you talking about Diamond?
10 episodes.
Yeah. DC splitting from Diamond and going to Lunar and what's the other one? UCS, I think. Something like that. I've long been skeptical of the distributor monopoly that's existed in the comic book realm for the last, 20 years? And up until the last month or two, I've read a lot of screeds from stores that also were decrying that monopoly, you know, on The Beat or CBR or Bleeding Cool or, you know, whatever. And it's fascinating now to see DC drop Diamond and kind of elevate these other companies and now watch the huge outcry against that. I read a pretty cutting commentary on it that basically just said comic stores just really hate change. Doesn't they matter if that change is something they've been crying for decades. But the way DC did handle it, I think was pretty poor. Mm-hmm. Not only the timing, not only the length of time that they gave people, the reaction window, maybe I should say, but also completely cutting out from Diamond, not just adding the other distributors in addition. The other distributors have higher rates and different things, which is real rough on brick and mortar retailers that already have pretty bad margins. Like, I agree with the like high level idea, but all of the ways that were carried out were bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things going on with the DC switch, right? What's the best way to start? Yeah, I think it's the fact that a lot of retailers are smashed by the fact that the economy of scale that Diamond provided, particularly if you're a middle-sized or smaller comic book store, is like a huge hit. And the fact that it's two distributors is also an issue. The fact that it's not actual competition, the fact that it's only DC that's done this, also screws them because it doesn't actually lead to like price competition. Like all the things people love about capitalism, or they say they love about capitalism, aren't actually possible because it's not real competition. It's just, it's kind of like if you know anything about the soda market, where you can, you have to buy Coke from the Coke bottler, Pepsi from the Pepsi bottler. And that's why you frequently don't see particularly like fast food, like restaurants offer multiple types of soda. They will only offer like Coke or Pepsi. So it's a very similar kind of situation. And the other thing is that it looks like most comic book stores had a really close relationship with Diamond financially, in the sense that Diamond was willing to float them large amounts of capital if they fell behind. And that, of course, is probably less possible with this new arrangement. Like, we don't know what the terms would be. So if, say a small comic book store ends up a little bit behind on its payments, is it just going to immediately fold? Or is it going to be able to get the kind of financial backing that they were able to get from Diamond? That seems to be sort of my take. Like, I think overall it's probably better. Diamond, as someone who worked in the comic book industry for about 5 years in a comic book store, Diamond's kind of a garbage company. But I can definitely see why retailers, even though they are, many of them are very conservative and risk averse, I can definitely see why retailers would rather have the devil they know than the devil, the new devil of these two new distributors.
Right. I did read one interesting kind of theory that the new-ish overlords of DC may view this as more specifically firing shots at Marvel, who is currently exclusive to Diamond. DC, during the Diamond shutdown during the pandemic, had already kind of broached things and started the setup process with Lunar and UCS. And so folks are theorizing that Diamond already appears to be on pretty shaky ground with halting payments and having to work out this pretty long repayment scheme and everything. And that if DC fully pulls out roughly a third of Diamond's stock and income, that they potentially tumble, which is a big blow to Marvel. I think it's a little tinfoily, but was interesting to say the least.
Yeah. I saw the Peter David thread, I guess, that you're referencing there. I'm a little less convinced. I do think that one of the other things is that these distributors are also retailers. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you enter into a distribution deal, I mean, you worked in the game industry, right?
Yeah.
Did kind of stuff for a while, Will, right?
Yeah.
You have to give some financial information, and they will be giving financial information to their competitors, which, you know, some, again, the conservative nature of a lot of these people kind of argues against that. So, anyway, by these people, I'm comic book store owners, and I mean small C conservative. Although many of them are also big C conservative.
fair. I mean, I guess I'm just going to have to see how it plays out at this point. I have not been physically buying comics for about a year because the local shop that I went to and had, frankly, too many subscriptions at, wound up going under, partly due to that overextension of credit from Diamond that eventually got cut off. So yeah, I don't know. We will see where it goes in the future. I have a real soft spot for the comic industry, so whatever happens, I hope it survives.
I mean, Marvel's going to survive because Disney backs it and it's like an idea and funding factory for them, right?
No.
Like, it'll just, it might survive in a totally different format, but it's going to survive.
Yeah, Will was a little imprecise. He means the direct market comic stores.
Yes. Okay.
Like, Marvel Comics and DC Comics and probably Image and Dark Horse and probably Ani too will survive. But will the direct market survive?
Yes. No. I should have been more specific.
It's been dying for 30 years or almost 30 years now, right? Like, it's going to die.
I mean, yeah, I guess that's true. Like, the 90s is 30 years ago now, so yes.
Oh, geez.
So, like, I mean, the direct market is
old.
I mean, sorry, I can add? I don't know. but, like, the direct market's been dying for so long. It's everything that's happening has just been fumes. It's not a model made for our current world. I mean, it's super not a model made for our current world. It's generally not a modern model made for the world as it was before COVID. All right, Roy, tell us about Tom King.
Yeah, I want to talk briefly about Tom King's Batman. I've read the first three trade paperbacks now. And I'm about halfway through the second one, The War of Jokes and Riddles, which is, I think, a little bit weaker than the third volume, even though it's trying to swing for the rafters by doing a Joker story. But it's an okay Joker story rather than like a fantastic one. But I'm really quite enjoying it. I think the art is really good. The artist that they had it's actually some of the best David Finch art that I've seen in like a long time. Like if you compare the first time I encountered Finch, which was New Avengers, and we're talking about New Avengers number one with Bendis in 2003, 2004, 2005.
Sounds close, but I couldn't tell you exactly.
When did New Avengers come out? Let me Google that real quick. But
I'm googling it. You do the talk.
It's just so much better than I remember. That's Finch being
five.
Five, yeah, that makes sense because I was living in Lurie One. But The writing is really good. It's an interesting take on Batman. It's very Tom King-y because, like, you know, if you've read, like, Vision and then Mr. Miracle, which I also
Mr. Miracle run.
Like, really digesting. It's very heady, so, and with all that's going on in the world, actually, I've been taking it pretty slow getting through it. He likes, you know, to write about characters struggling with and overcoming trauma, and Batman is an excellent character for that, being that the murder of his parents is central to his...
If he overcomes it, doesn't he just quit being Batman?
Well, that's the question that it comes to, right? That's one of the questions and themes that he's playing with, right? That's the central... I don't want to spoil... Like, I know what happens because I follow spoilers. But I don't want to spoil for anyone who hasn't read Tom King Batman or kept up with Batman. But his relationship
with Batman... I thought we were a spoiler full cast.
Right, but it's, like, currently ongoing. You know what I mean? Like, Will, like, I don't know. Do you want to ever read Tom King Batman?
Or I mean, probably at some point, but I don't know how quick it'll be.
I'm trying to be generous here, but, like, that's a question at the theme... That's a question and theme at the center of the Catwoman and Batman dynamic in the Tom King books. But he's more Batman as a force of will rather than Batman as, like, the world's greatest detective or Batman as, like, the way he's not psychologically damaged Batman in the, like, Grant Morrison or, well, early Grant Morrison, Arkham Asylum, or Alan Moore way. It's more like Batman.
Grant Morrison, the superhero of all forces.
Yeah. I'm more thinking like the, like, 80s, 90s Batman, like that kind of, like, like Batman Returns Batman. You know, that's, you know, gonna, the Joker's gonna, you know, shoot Batgirl and almost murder Jim Gordon, and the Batman's gonna have a laugh with him at the end, right? That's like crazy Batman. That's like the biggest example of it, from The Killing Joke. It's not that kind of struggling with trauma kind of thing. It's more, you know, willpower and the limits of it, and Batman as, like, a force of will. And it's just, like, a really, really interesting take on Batman that I haven't really figured out whether I like it or not. Like, I'm enjoying it, but I'm not sure, like, at the end of the day, if it is a Batman that I think should be an enduring take on the character, but it's definitely interesting. And so I'm going to keep reading. I'm trying to read it really slow so I don't burn through it and spend a bunch of money on trade paperbacks right now. I would definitely prop it. And if you're interested in a conventional but different take on Batman, it's definitely something worth reading.
Cool.
I don't know if I have anything to add to that. Will?
To the Batman thing?
Yeah, or want to head to the Dragon.
Were you telling me to move on?
Your call. Either way, that's why
I watched Chris Nolan and Tim Burton Batmans on HBO Max. So,
there we go.
Not all of them, I don't think. I think something is missed.
It's not the Chris Nolan ones aren't there. It's Batfleck and the Tim Burton era ones. It's not Chris Nolan. Well, I watched the Batman, like the Batman movie, like the original one from
1989.
Yeah, was that when it was?
Yes.
Is a really interesting movie. It's a very interesting take on Batman that and the Joker in particular, because Al and I went on a Christopher Nolan kick at the end of the month where we watched end of last month where we watched all three. Of the Christopher Nolan Batman movies, which I adore those movies, particularly The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, of course. That explains the Revenge of the Sith. Go ahead.
And they're all very enjoyable. But Batman is just such an interesting movie because it's not like a lot of... It's like this weird liminal space between modern Batman stories, both in... all sorts of different mediums and older Batman stories. And, you know, Jack Nicholson's Joker is so radically different than modern takes on the character that it's really weird to be honest with you. But it's still very enjoyable. still very enjoyable to watch. So I would definitely take, you should definitely watch it if you have HBO Max.
I will always have a soft spot for that movie and, of course, for Batman Returns, which I actually think is a superior movie.
I hate Batman Returns, actually.
See, I really enjoyed Returns. I've never liked that first Batman. That is not a Joker I'm interested in seeing, nor is it especially a Batman I'm interested in seeing.
I mean, to be fair, like, to be honest with you, like, I'm not interested in basically any take on the Joker at this point. Rewatching, like, I have complicated feelings about the Dark Knight's Joker. But I think overall it's been a relatively negative impact on pop culture. I mean, I've spilled a lot of literal ink. I've written pieces and all kinds of stuff about the Dark Knight, and I've thought a lot about it. And I think overall it's been pretty negative, but it is definitely an interesting and compelling movie, but
it's a negative impact on pop culture, but as a movie in and of itself, I think it is very, very well made. I think it is the closest the movie has come to feeling like comic book Batman and comic book Joker, and that's, as a comic nerd, that's kind of what I want from it. So I will always really, really enjoy that movie, despite its negative impact. I don't think DC is generally good at making movies that feel anything like their comics.
Yeah, I would agree. Not since maybe the original Richard Donner Superman. That I think very much that era of Superman.
And Shazam.
Okay, yeah, Shazam. Shazam is really overlooked, I think, unrightfully so. It was good.
And to some extent, Wonder Woman. Not so much movie, not so much similar to comics, but just well enough done that I didn't really.
It's so slow. That's my biggest complaint about the Wonder Woman movie. Mm-hmm. It's just a very slow watching experience, but it is very good.
So are a lot of Wonder Woman comics, though, right? Like, when Greg Rucka is the, like, definitive modern voice of your comics, they're going to be slow.
That's fair.
Azzarello
run, that felt much more actiony to me.
I don't like something about Azzarello's dialogue has always driven me crazy, and I can never get into his comics. I know I would like them if I can get past that, but I just can never seem to. I recognize they're good, but I don't enjoy them.
Okay. Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm not overly fond of his. His various runs on things, and I've encountered a remarkable amount of it. And I was never a big what was his Vertigo series? 100 Bullets. I was never a 100 Bullets person.
Mm-hmm. It's his dialogue. I really wanted to like
his dialogue is pretty meh.
Yeah, everything about it suggested I would like it, and it just didn't do it for me. As evidenced by my revenge of the Sith thoughts, and also my thoughts generally on Dark Knight Rises, good, believable dialogue is extraordinarily important to me. And you can get away with it not being good or believable if it's stylized enough. But I don't feel like Azzarello or those movies hit stylized. I think they're like, I need a lot of winking at the camera if you're going to be campy and that kind of, like, if they're going to be campy and not acknowledge it. Like, I just need you to acknowledge it. You can't ask me to take that too seriously.
I mean, that's fair, but no Christopher Nolan movie, except maybe Memento, should ever be accused of having good dialogue. And that includes The Dark Knight Rises, or The Dark Knight.
Yes, like, but
sterilized or stylized.
But The Dark Knight, by virtue of having the Joker in it, it's constantly winking at you about it. Whereas Bane never does, right? Like you have to let me know you're aware of how ridiculous you are if you're going to be that ridiculous.
I mean, this might just be fundamentally different readings of the movie, but like, that movie is constantly telling you how ridiculous Bane is and how ridiculous everything that is going on in the movie is. Like, that's kind of part of the character of Bane in the movie.
I feel like it's supposed to be over the top, but it's not, like, but it's over the top in an overly no smiles were.
I mean, maybe, yeah, I mean, that's Christopher Nolan. I don't know if the man has ever actually smiled in his life, but...
I also tend not to love his movies. Like, I absolutely...
I tend not to love his movies either, but I do think he and Batman in the era in which that movie emerged were very good. Yeah. It was a very good pairing.
Overall, I like the trilogy. I don't like Dark Knight Rises, but I don't hate it. And I like the other two very much. I think they're fun. I just don't think they're necessarily super good. And I think that's a distinction.
That's fair. Yeah.
I mean, there are definitely worse trilogies around.
I mean, luckily Snyder didn't get to make three movies. Oh, yes, he did.
Well, I would not be surprised if we get another... If the Snyder Cut is successful, I would not be surprised if
we have three. We have a Return, whatever the name of the new Superman
Man of Steel.
Right? Man of Steel, got it, dude, Man of Steel. Man of Steel, the only movie I can't make it all the way through, Batman vs. Superman and Justice League.
Which is funny, because the best part of Batman vs. Superman is the last 20 minutes after the fight.
I've seen all of it out of order, but if I can't, like, everything about that movie makes me want to put my head through a wall. I hate it so much.
That's fair.
Like, every bit of dialogue, every bit of character, it's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the characters mean and why they mean what they do. It doesn't understand any character in the movie. And, like, a reimagined, like, Man of Steel is a perfectly fine movie if you're like, by the way, that Man of Steel is Hyperion and not Superman.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's fine. That's not Superman. Like, if you're going to make a Superman movie, it has to bear resemblance beyond powers to the character. Like, just slapping the name on things won't do it. But, like...
100% agreed.
Yeah. Batman, you can change Batman vs. Superman to be Hyperion versus Night Owl, and it's still a terrible movie. Like, that movie is just bad.
I would watch it just for the novelty of, you know, Squadron Supreme characters being used.
I can't get through it. Like, literally everything about it makes my eyes want to roll out of their head. I'll never get it. It's fine. Sorry. Moving on.
Should we move to the new topic? We've wandered far and wide here on Batman.
the Dragon's Path. We went on the Dragon's Path of Batman. Go ahead. What's the Dragon's Path? Will?
Yeah. Okay, so a lot of folks these days have heard of The Expanse, right? The Netflix show, obviously based on some books by James S.A. Corey, which is actually a pseudonym for two other authors, one of which is Daniel Abraham. So The Dragon's Path is his the first novel of his fantasy series. The fantasy series is actually called The Dagger and the Coin, talking about like the two different ways to influence the world, right, through like power or money, effectively. And so it's fun. I had actually read this first novel probably half a dozen years ago or more, and finally decided, you know what, this whole five book series is actually done. I can start another epic fantasy and actually finish it instead of all the others that are, you know, two or three books in and will never go any further. So I've reread this first one, and I really dig it. The tone is somewhere in between, say, Game of Thrones and Stormlight Archive, right? Like somewhere in between Martin and Sanderson. Not as heavy as Martin, not as like bubblegum action-y as Sanderson. But there is still a lot of politicking, and this also adds in a lot more focus on trade and monetary concerns and how that can affect politicking, which you get a touch of in Game of Thrones, but not a lot yet. So just I enjoy it. One of the main characters is a banker. So that, of course, amuses me as a banker myself. We don't get to be heroes very often, or at least protagonists. Not sure yet if she's a hero. We'll see.
Spoiler, no. I've never.
Yeah, maybe not.
It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I well, mean, actually.
No, she's one of the more sympathetic characters in the book.
Oh, she definitely is. She definitely is. And part of what hooked me on this book when I first read it is the like dawning realization as the first book goes that Abraham has been mucking with your perceptions. And sorry, we're a spoilerific show, so my bad. But there's a character who comes off at first as the shy, sympathetic, nerdy guy, right? Knows always in a book, effectively the jocks, the professional soldiers and knights and stuff are making him the butt of all their jokes and all that sort of thing. And so you think, knowing how these epic fantasies normally go, that he is going to, you know, grow and become this heroic guy eventually, and everyone's going to bow down to him. But by the time you finish the first book, like, I'm pretty sure we've just been watching his descent into becoming like the big bad, or at least the big bad's like chief lieutenant.
How far have you only read the first one?
Yeah. I just finished rereading the first one. I started the second earlier today, so I'm like 40 pages into the second.
Yeah, I read the first
So
three before I fell off kind of hard. I found eventually many of the characters, I just couldn't care about them anymore. So, I mean, it could just be some, like, it was also like the time in my life and, you know, all that kind of stuff, so. Right. Your mileage may vary.
Yeah. Well, as far as the characters go, there is one other neat thing that I do like about it that I would recommend to people. If you enjoyed Serenity and Firefly, there is a pair of characters in the book, one of which is a former general who was on the losing side of a war and his right-hand man. And the two of them are just effectively Mal and Zoe from Firefly. That very same type of interaction and banter, which amuses me to no end. So there you go. I'll check back in after I finish the whole series. Man, we lost Aaron, who I thought for sure was going to kick us over to the game section.
I am ready. Sorry. I got messaged and I don't know that book and I'm not going to read it. So I got a little bit lost. All right. So we're over to video games or games and video games. I want to talk about the Nintendo Switch sale. The summer sale is up. And as listeners know, I'm playing a lot of RPGs and I just spent way too much money buying the following. Ni no Kuni is on sale for $20, down from, 50 or 60. If you like Studio Ghibli movies, Ghibli helped make that. Each Banner Saga game is on the Banner Saga game for on sale for $5, $7, and $9. Nice. I've heard they're fantastic strategy RPGs, so I got those. Langrisser 1 and 2 are on sale for like $30 to $35, something in that general area, so I grabbed those because, again, strategy RPGs are generally amazing. Roy would really like Langrisser. I don't know if he'll get it, but he would really like it. The Grandia HD collection is on sale for like $30, so I grabbed that.
What all does the collection have in it?
Definitely 1 and 2, and then there was something else, but I only cared about 1 and 2, so I didn't pay attention.
Okay. I mean, 2 is one of my favorites. 2 was a great highlight of the Dreamcast for me.
I really love both 1 and 2. I think they're... I don't know if I'm going to get around to playing them. One of my quarantine rules I've said before is no replaying things, but an HD remaster might be different enough, and I don't really remember them all that well, so it might feel like a new game. We'll see. But the battle system isn't the game, it's just really, really fun and well made. I got Divinity 2 Original Sin.
Amazing game.
It's a turn-based RPG, so hopefully it'll be one of the few modern games I actually like. And I got Dragon Quest XI. although I got that at a different sale. It's the only one I've actually played, and I'm not far into it. I'm like 10 hours in, and I cannot possibly recommend it enough. It is absolutely delightful. Like, the world feels lived in and fun. I was recently listening to and Roy will know the name of the gentleman, a guy who used to write for Kotaku, Tim something?
Tim Rogers.
Tim Rogers, thanks. And he was comparing the Dragon Quest games. I beat 4, I'm in the middle of 5. He was comparing the Dragon Quest games to Chrono Trigger, and how Chrono Trigger is so beloved because it matches its structure to its gimmick so well, and it makes everything else feel like it really fits. The time travel being the gimmick, the structure being the way the plot moves. And the Dragon Quests that work do the same thing, is his argument. And having played 4, a bit of 5 and a bit of 11, that's exactly it. And I think 11, in a modern way, exemplifies that amazingly well. The game just feels lived in and real and, like, warm. And it's just, I cannot, like, it's... The accolades it's gotten are warranted, and the game is on sale in the Switch eShop for $40, and people should be getting it. And the music is unreal good.
Awesome. I do love me some RPG music.
Yeah.
I mean, it's full symphonic. You should really, really look into it if you like RPG music. Like, if you liked Chrono Trigger, it's 80 hours, right? Apparently, the way people in Japan play Dragon Quest games are as a bedtime story. They do it for like a half hour before bed nightly. Again, this is from the same video that I've learned this. But like, I'm playing them in smaller chunks. I'm trying to play about an hour a day while in the middle of playing other things, and they're just really well put together. The older ones, if you want to play, I suggest playing with some kind of emulation because they are healthy. They are healthier experiences without the grinding. But 11 doesn't have a lot of grinding, and all the enemies are just visible in front of you, so if you don't want to fight them, don't. Like, I really highly recommend it. I super prop it.
Awesome.
Oh, also 5 is, like, the best, like, the coolest plot ever in a video game. I don't want to, well, I guess I could spoil it. It's 30 years old, right? 35 years old. But, you start off as literally a 6-year-old, and then as you grow up, you become enslaved. You like have to figure out how to free yourself with the help of like friendly monsters, and like eventually you choose who you marry. You end up having kids. You go adventuring with your kids. It's just this ridiculously cool epic thing. So if you want to grab 5, it's real cool. And it's got that whole. It's a Super Nintendo game, so it's got that exact nostalgic look. If you played those games. It's like $15 if you want to play it on your phone. That's how I'm playing it. There's a reasonable amount of grinding, but the game is just like exudes charm. So I suggest you emulate and just cut that part out by cheating. But if you don't mind the grind, like, or you just want something to mindlessly do on your phone between really great story plot points, 5 is very, very good.
Awesome.
I mean, and Fire Emblem stole its gimmick, so, you know.
Stole its gimmick? Not from my experience with Dragon Age games. Not Dragon Age, I'm sorry. Dragon Quest games. Like, they're monster assembling games. That's not what you do in Fire Emblem.
Dragon Quest games aren't monster assembling games. What?
Don't you, like, get monsters on your...
Oh, yeah. It invented that, but that's not in every game. It's not... a huge part of the gimmick of any of them except for part of 5. Like, there's a Dragon Quest Monsters series that's basically like Dragon Quest Pokemon, but that's not the main Dragon Quest series. The main Dragon Quest series play like the Super Nintendo and PlayStation Final Fantasies.
Okay.
But yeah, they're great. They have monster grabbing, but no, Dragon Quest 5 is the first game that I'm aware of that lets you like have choose who you marry, have kids that are different based on who you marry, and then
that's the gimmick you're thinking of. Yeah. I think Suikoden.
Yeah. Dragon Quest Five. Dragon Quest Five. definitely predates Super Nintendo.
It does it? Okay, like, then yeah.
Dragon Quest V is like an early-ish Super Nintendo game.
Also, yeah, I was going to say. It would have had to have been maybe 95 or so.
Yeah. And Suikoden is 99 or 2000.
No, I thought the original one was earlier than that. Because isn't the original one on the Super Nintendo?
No, the Suikoden one is a PlayStation game.
Okay.
I'm 92 for Dragon Quest V.
Yeah. And I'm checking for Suikoden 1, but... Suikoden 1 is 95.
Okay. So I wasn't entirely insane.
It predates it by 3 years, but Suikoden is a PlayStation game. It's a very early PlayStation game. Suikoden 2, which is what I was thinking of, is 98. Also, you don't have kids that you play with in Suikoden.
But did you get married, right?
None of the Suikodens that I can think of you get married.
But you do. I could maybe confuse it with something else.
Yeah. Okay. Get moral of the story, get Dragon Quest XI, and if you don't mind some grinding and retro gaming, get Dragon Quest V. Those games are fantastic.
Slight detour real quick to re-slop HBO Max, because I just saw on Reddit that almost all of the DC films will be leaving July 1st.
What?
Yes. They will be keeping, evidently, Shazam, Aquaman, Joker, Green Lantern, and Supergirl 84, and all 13 other live-action DC films will be leaving. Mm.
All right.
I mean, live action means you're not missing too much, as long as it has the cartoon films.
Yeah.
Although, God, the Killing Joke.
Just seems bizarre, you know, 1 month after you launch your new service to lose all those, frankly, still at this point, kind of tentpole draw type of films. Weird. Anyway.
I mean... They probably had to cut deals to ever get them.
Yeah. Almost certainly.
All right. Game Gear Micro?
The Game Gear Micro. So, retro gaming, right? Mini consoles and such is all the rage these days. The NES Mini, the Super Nintendo, so on and so forth. And it is Sega's 60th anniversary this year, and a game writer in Japan for Famitsu magazine had been hyping that they were going to break some big Sega news this week last week on Thursday, and that news turned out to be some cloud gaming arcade business, which we're not going to get into, but some other news then broke on Wednesday that people were worried was the big news, and that is Sega dipping in again on the retro console nostalgia train for their old Game Gear system, which some folks might remember. It was kind of same time period as the Game Boy, but roughly brick size and weight. Had a color screen, and you basically had to stay plugged into the wall the whole time because you would blow through six AA batteries, nothing flat. Turns out, you know, bright color portable screens at the time were not energy efficient.
This is terrible.
Yeah. Well, and it gets worse. So they decided, you know, we had this portable system. How about we make this weird retro version of it for the Japanese market, Japanese only, and we're going to do the Game Gear Micro, which is collectible. There are four different versions. They have different colors, of course, and each one has a different assortment of games, only four each. The system itself, and you will laugh so hard when you see a picture of this, and a person can fit two of them in one hand. Because they're basically they're 3.1 inch wide by 1.7 high by 0.8 deep. The screen itself, the color LCD is 1.15. To put that in perspective, an Apple Watch screen is larger.
Wow.
Yeah. So the, it, I mean, it's obviously, you know, tiny things, collectability, like these are big draws in the Japanese market, but it just feels so bizarre and nigh on unplayable at that size. Not only being able to see what's going on the screen, but also being able to use the D-pad and the buttons. It's just mystifying. On the plus side, they're only about $50 a pop.
This is the worst product I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. So slops to that. Don't, like, I'm still a Sega fanboy, but man, they make decisions about just, as well as Warner Brothers.
I mean, I don't get this entire movement anyway, because I'd rather just emulate, right? Like, emulating is so free and so easy. Like, I'm dumb at computers. Like, it's a meme in all my group chats that, like, I can handle emulation just fine. It's not hard. It's really download emulators, shove shit in folder with emulator name, press play. So, like, I don't super get putting money into these in the first place, but, like, this one is atrocious. Like, four different consoles with four games each?
Yep.
Is, like, you can fit all of these games, like, literally all of these games on literally anything. They're they're ridiculously, ridiculously tiny.
I was looking at this and I was talking to another friend and I was like, you know, they don't even hardly need to, like, develop their own system or whatever. You know, like, so many e-readers, right, are just, like, the Nook tablet I've got is just a stock Android tablet with two different Nook, like, Barnes & Noble apps on it. One for the store, one for actually reading the books. Like, mm-hmm. If they just released a Switch-esque form factor, like, Android tablet with a Sega-branded emulator or, like, game store on it that sold, like, all of these old games that they had rights to, like, that would probably be a product that would sell and do well and, like, have its own little niche in the market. But this seems so bizarre.
It's real, real bad. I wish I had another thing to say about that.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems awful, so.
It's good job, Sega. You'll never learn. All right. Well, gentlemen, talk about Legends of Runeterra again.
I know you all talked about it last time, but I'll just be real quick. I've been playing it. I haven't jumped into the limited mode yet, but I've been really enjoying it. The production values are ridiculous. It really does put all the other card games to shame. Even Hearthstone, which is also the other one with all the bells and whistles. It's just a really smooth user experience. I found a lot of strategic depth to it. It's extremely free-to-play friendly. The way its level-up system works is also sweet. I may have hit, I think, a little bit of a wall with my progression with slightly upgraded starter decks, so I'll need to start actually investing my wild cards in things. So that's sort of my next step, is to sort of try to really figure out the meta and where I want to spend my wild cards. I'm trying to be more conservative than I was or am with Arena, where I have a tendency to be like, oh, that deck looks sweet. Let me pour all my wild cards into it. And then it sucks. And then I don't have any wild cards. So, yeah, but I'm really, really enjoying it. I've also jumped into Hearthstone Battlegrounds, which I'm also really enjoying. It's extremely fun and just really easy, but also with, like, lots of strategic depth. And it has the right amount of randomness most of the time, or at least the randomness right now seems fun. It's not perfectly balanced. I think some of the dragon cards in particular are a little OP if you get the synergies going and difficult to beat, but otherwise it is just really, really fun, and I finally I'm starting to see what people see in the auto battler genre, and maybe it will cause me to put my toes into the other two. But considering they're more based on MOBAs, which I'm notoriously bad at and do not enjoy, maybe my toe being in will immediately withdraw back. I'll be like, you know what? I'll stick with card games. At least I understand them. And, you know, anything that requires too much clicking, I'm not very good at in fast order. So, yeah, but both are really enjoyable. And I've been enjoying them a lot the last week. So it's been exactly a week since I loaded Runeterra because I got my 7th day reward today.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fun game. I haven't delved back in much lately, but it does some fairly neat things. And when some friends tried to explain it to me, I really had to get in and play it to get a feel for how it actually worked with the attack action and the priority back and forth and everything. And it's good, though.
I think the priority system is actually one of the best I've ever played.
Yeah.
Like, it can't get quite as, like, over the top as Magic's, but I think it's actually a compromise between kind of, like, Throne's priority. Like, the game doesn't, like, really demand a mastery of the priority system, but the priority system is, the priority system is flexible enough to still be fun, but not the focus of it, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it offers you some depth to do some interesting things, mm-hmm. but is not too overwhelming for, you know, a quick game I'm playing on my phone.
Right. And I think that unlike Magic and Thrones, it's designed in a way that the game doesn't revolve around triggers and the stack and Magic, but also like messing around with priority and timing. There's where I'm going to go in for. The game doesn't really revolve around timing. And that I find to be really refreshing.
Yeah. I think it's definitely fun.
All right. That's it for this week, everyone. Have a great one. We'll be right back.